Carol.
Oh, okay. Well, I brought the I brought the painting back, Secret Fire, because I thought our lesson last time, which I listened to on tape, was talking about this much, so much with the idea of the four elements. And it says that the four elements come from the earth. And that explained to me a little bit about this painting, because I realized it was the four elements, you know, fire, water, earth, and air. But then I thought, why is it the body? Why is the four elements here made up of the body itself? And then in the text it tells us that the earth, or the body, produces the four elements. And that answered, you know, that part of the question for me. And then the four elements form the treasure house. And I feel that in this painting, in our text, they go on to form the treasure house after this image. But I've got the paintings that are coming next worked out. And from the unconscious, it's come that this tree is going to go through a circulatory process. And they've talked about the circulatory process in here, but it seems to me that this fire tree is going to go through a circulatory process through the four elements, and that seems like a sort of departure from the way that it's described in the text. So I thought that was interesting and wondered what that might mean. But the next paintings, I think, will concentrate on this idea of the four elements.
Super. I'll look forward to it.
And I think with the four elements, we had the idea before of fire. The Holy Ghost is fire, and the fire initiates this process of the four elements.
Mm-hmm.
And the fire is also blood, they said. And here, the fire is also blood here, because lava is the blood of the earth, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And here the fire springs up from the blood of this figure.
Beautiful.
So I just thought I would...
I see it. I hadn't, wouldn't, what I like is so much as, you know, you link up the body, which is what, the body, the earth, and the four elements, which is what's linked up in the text.
That puzzled me, because I thought, well, the body is earth. Why would the body have the four elements?
Mm-hmm.
And then here we're having it explained to us why it is that the four elements are the earth,
yeah,
too.
Well, I'll be interested to see what comes next, and, you know, let's not talk about it. Just give it its own space, and then it'll probably be a commentary on how this text needs to change for today.
Well, I feel a departure here.
Yeah,
at this
good
point, I feel I'm making a departure from the text.
Good.
And there's some sort of elaboration that has to go on at this point,
mm-hmm,
that I don't find in here.
Mm-hmm. Super.
So I thought I would just share that with everybody.
Thank you. Georgia. Next chapter.
Well, I'm working on the next one right now, so hopefully this summer it'll be done.
Quick review. Ash to Ash, detail left over, is from the Anglican Book of Prayer. I have no idea. It is not biblical. This is just a detail. But that is taken from Genesis 3:19, if you're dying to know.
What is it?
The phrase we have in the text, ash to ash, ashes to ashes. Remember, we were trying to figure out, where did that come from? Is that biblical? And I was saying, well, I don't know. I will check. And it is not biblical. It's from the Book of Common Prayer, which I think is Anglican, right, if I got that right. And that is a reference to Genesis 3:19. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. Just a detail. I said I would check on that. The other question, which I thought about and left kind of unanswered, was Eileen said that I kind of, did I not contradict myself when I said that the process keeps churning whether you get it or not. Like we're seeing this process go through and he doesn't understand it, that doesn't make any difference. It keeps producing the next stage. And then I said, but you can stop it at some points if you don't get it. And that's a contradiction. Well, I had to think about it. And I think what the difference is power. If you approach the thing with power, it'll stop. And it'll turn against you. If you just don't get it, it keeps producing itself. Just a little detail. Yes.
Oh, I couldn't see your table.
What you call power will? If you try to force your own will?
That if you force your own will, I think, you know, the biggest danger you see practically is people try to turn the process to help them better at their self-centeredness. Help them to be better self-centered people. Be more effectively self-centered. And to more effectively, I guess you could say will, but to propagate their persona irrespective of moral considerations. I think that's the big key. You just me, and me over you, and too bad if there's any harm done. That seems to be, and that's the shadow of our time. And when it's contaminated, when we're contaminated with that, then the thing, I think, does stop. But see, he's not into power. He just doesn't know what to make of it. So that's why it keeps on. And the other place, I think, where you see it is in schizophrenics who are so obliterated, there's no power there. So that it keeps on producing itself, whether it's assimilated or not.
And I'm thinking about the example that you've given a few times about the woman who has the affair and has the dream sort of tells her that.
Definitely.
So
power.
That falls in that. Well, wasn't the first time okay, but the second time.
Oh, I misunderstood. Sorry, I misunderstood.
Right, the woman that had the dream the first time.
I was thinking of my physical therapist.
This is the woman who had the dream and says she ended up having an affair.
Right, but see, she didn't go with power the second time.
So, but the question of what's moral and who decides then sort of that seems to enter the picture here.
The unconscious decides.
So it's something around intent, that may be too intense?
Yeah, it's hard. What's so hard is, you know, Jung makes this distinction between superego and conscience. Big distinction. And superego is like the Ten Commandments and following the laws. And the conscience is that you complete yourself. And you're allowed to break some rules along the way if you are doing that. That seems to be the difference. He would say conscience is from the self. And superego is from the superego. I don't know exactly how to give you consistently applicable answer, because it's conscience, it's always different. But I think, you know, if you think of the word ego, not in the psychological sense, but in the popular sense of egotistical, that's the thing that's not forgiven. Egotism is not forgiven. Pushing yourself into the limelight, no matter who you hurt. That seems to be the thing to stop it. So you could say, in a way, when she had that affair the first time, it was kind of shadow-based. But somehow she was able to get away with it because, as far as herself was concerned, it was all right. The second time, she wouldn't have been able to get away with it. So in the first case, even though you could say it was an egotistical motivation, there was something else behind it. And she was forgiven, so to speak, because of that other thing behind it. Once she got the thing behind it, she would not have been forgiven from the point of view of the unconscious if she had done it again. Because then it would have been sheer ego. So it's really a mess.
It just occurred to me that kind of boils down to what is it in service to, and in many ways, only you know that.
Only the self knows that.
Right. Only the individual who's participating in whatever really knows what it's in service to, and even they have a hard time necessarily getting the clarity.
And that's why we're doing the dream work, to see what, and even what mistakes do you have to make.
Right.
I think it's just as, you know, Jung has that beautiful passage. I'm not sure I could fish it up in a moment. But he says, it's possible to miss your final accomplishment as much as it is possible to miss your final guilt. And you need both. It's a little heavy if you think about it. There are mistakes you have to make. But I don't think I can give you here's a general rule because it's so individual, but maybe I could at least give you some idea of the extent of the confusion that's involved. But that's what we're wrestling with all the time in our work. And I have seen dreams of people, let's say, it's funny because when I was up in Toronto, we got into a discussion about this, apropos our talk about Coet and Kernberg. This guy, what's his name, Winnicott, has the idea that there's such a thing as a false self. That would be the ego, egotism, and that the therapist should support that because that is really protecting the real self. And when the real self is ready to manifest, it'll break that down. Well, I can think of, I mean, the classic dream of the false self today is the SUV, the big SUV. And I've seen dreams where people had to trade in their SUV before they could take the journey. I've seen dreams where people got to the starting point of their journey in their SUV. It's weird. So one case, it's one thing, and another case, it's another. Greed and power and egotism, for some people, is what allows them to start the journey, and for other people, it's what they have to sacrifice. So in that case, I said, you know, this person was saying in that seminar, these are trainees, that we should accept this. And I'm saying, whoa, this is why we do dream work. There are some cases where you do have to accept it and really support the phony person. And there are times when you need to challenge it. And how? By looking at the dream. How do you know? By looking at the dream. So this is the issue of morality and what do you have to error do you have to incur? What errors do you have to avoid? And how do you establish a relationship with the unconscious in the process? I think everybody is different. You see the size of the issue, at least. I mean, there's no clear answer, but there is an issue to realize has to be individually assessed and what the terms of assessment are. So they were the two themes that were left over from last time. Quick review. Just main themes so far have been the darkness, the flood, the prison, Holy Spirit, the house, the earth. We've said that a million times. The main image in the house chapter, remember, was the light of the sun and moon and the blood on the rock. And today we're, and last time and today, we have been and will be talking about the earth. And I gave you 7 meanings of the earth, the unconscious, the mystery, the body, the prima materia, the unio corporalis, God and human. That's just review, nothing new there. Last time, we talked about the earth as the unconscious. And just to give you one sentence to keep in mind from each point on 342, I think the quote that springs out of is that the earth is the elements which are separated out and then come back to the earth. That's the quote on 342. For from the earth are the elements separated by dying, and to it do they return by quickening. She calls that a portrayal of the nature of the unconscious in this process, in that the unconscious creates a mess, and on the earth, and then resolves it eventually for your life on the earth. Another meaning of the earth is the mystery, and that's on the bottom of 342. Man is ashes, and to ashes he shall return. The idea there that the ash for the medieval mind is what endures. We think of it as waste, but for them it's the unburnable, the part of the stuff that didn't burn up.
And that's where the secret fire comes from the ash in the painting. That's lava ash all around it.
Another meaning of earth is the body. And that is on the second part of the quote. We started on 342. The top 343, the body that is the earth. Meaning that the earth is, the earth in symbolism in the text refers to the fact that this Sophie experience starts on the earth and ends on the earth through the desires of your body. Another meaning of the earth is the prima materia, and that was on 345. Second quote on 345, a boiling that is an evaporated water and afterwards returneth to its own former earthly form. The prima materia aspect would be the beginning nature of the Sophia experience being in desire. These are all just different angles on the same item. It's like, you know, if you look at a cone, ice cream cone, straight on, it looks like a triangle. This way it looks like a circle. That's what they're doing. They're just looking at the thing from different points of view, trying to capture its multifaceted nature. And the last point where we left off was the earth as the unio corporalis, the one body. Eventually, the awareness that we're trying to generate comes back to a reanimating of our emotional life on the earth. A change in the emotional life. And then we left off at 352.
352?
352, did we leave off? 352, yes. Questions? All sound familiar? I think this Earth chapter is particularly, it's not difficult, it's just so much material that doesn't really want to hold together unless you can easily slip into that symbolic thinking. She's looking at so many different characteristics. There's been one main theme pretty much in every chapter. Well, there's a main theme here, but it's really multifaceted. So we'll continue circling around it.
I have a question from last week's. You had talked about there being other ways to the end result besides the Sophia experience.
Yeah.
What were you referring to?
I thought about that. I think there are basic Jung. This is Jung according to Gary. There are four basic models for Jung's understanding of self. The hero myth, alchemy, Gnosticism, and Job. And so the Sophia and Gnosticism are almost the same.
But maybe not today.
We will find out as your painting communicates.
So you would call those four things?
How I try to do it is go through his work and see how the different things he says, which sometimes sound like contradictions, really make sense if you realize he has different ways of understanding it.
So you have different ways of understanding the journey.
Or I think people have different versions of the journey. The first one is the hero myth.
And there, it's really not the self that's being developed, but it's the first place where we see him mention the dialogue between the ego and the unconscious, that there's a dialogue to get established. But there, it's pretty much of a power metaphor. The ego slays the destructive effects of the unconscious and receives the positive guidance from the unconscious. Or that may even be giving it a little too much credit. The ego slays the destructive aspect of the unconscious, and with the freedom gained, creates new things. See, it's very still much in the ego. There is a recognition of another power, but you don't see that power is granted autonomy. And that's the book Symbols of Transformation. But it's really relevant to our work because it's actually what we do a lot of. It's where we spend most of our time, helping people overcome their negative symptoms, experience, depression. And very often when that's overcome, they say, thank you very much, goodbye. Some people so there I think you can see there's a first and a second. With these next three, I don't think necessarily they're sequentially. But then that was when Jung kind of fell apart after that, and he came up with a whole different concept based on the self. This is what these next three points of view are. And the first is alchemy. And that was really probably the first, if you wanted to go at all chronologically, alchemy is simply you look at your conflict and you endure your conflict, and eventually the conflict heals itself through the production of a third. The second model.
What is a key part to that, though, is that you endure it consciously?
Yes.
So you stay in the awareness of it.
Right.
You don't try to not be there.
You try to be there.
You try to be there.
And it's a crucifixion. It's a paralysis.
And this is where when people don't want to endure the conflict, they can get into addictive behaviors.
Absolutely.
Without acting out.
Yeah. Acting out is a way to avoid the conflict, and denying it is a way to avoid the conflict.
Projecting it?
Yeah, if you're projecting it, then you're generally denying it. You know, they've got the problem, I don't have the problem. The other model, which is what I call the Gnostic model. Remember, the Gnostic idea is that God gets trapped in the world of creation, as does Sophia. Sophia is sometimes in place of God here. Sophia, the female side of God, feminine side of God. And the agnostic has to live their life so that when they die, the piece of them that's in, the piece of God that's in them goes back to God. Well, Jung works with that as a metaphor for projection, that the self loses itself in the world. And we get thrown into situations where we are in fact meeting a part of ourselves that we don't know about, which is behind the complication of the situation that we got into. So this stresses the importance of with alchemy, you see you've already got the conflict. With this Gnostic model, you create the conflict by withdrawing the projection of the essence of yourself that's in that mess. So if you get in a fight with a boss, you get in a fight with a spouse, what you have to do is begin to realize what piece of you what piece of you has life sent you this bad experience to get to know.
So then the whole rest of the Gnostic idea is left out of the way we're talking about Sophia. Yeah. you could say. Because in Gnosticism, the light and the dark are still separated.
Oh, yeah. He's just taking this as a metaphor.
So when we talk about Gnosticism here, we're not talking about the whole ball of wax.
He's sort of extracting their structural concept of God and applying it to the psyche, which is that God or the self gets lost, and then we have to bring it back.
But then our modern experience of Sophia would go beyond this Gnostic idea of there being a separation of the dark and light, because we're trying to bring the dark and the light.
Well, the thing that Sophia emphasizes so much is that this experience is a body experience. If you think about what we've been talking about in the Sophia thing, is that you get into a situation which is complicated, emotionally, physically complicated, generally around sex and aggression. Either you're in love or in lust with somebody that is messing your life up, or you hate somebody who's messing your life up. So what you have to do then is extract from that experience the piece of yourself that is hidden in that experience. That's what we've been talking about, hopefully, in many, many different words throughout this whole time. And it's exactly like a Gnostic metaphor. The only emphasis is it's on the body. It's a physiological experience.
And in the end of the Gnostic metaphor, the light and the dark are separated. Is that right? Yes.
Well, he's not looking at it so exactly.
Right, but that's what I'm trying to get at, that we're not talking about that aspect of Gnosticism.
No, no.
We're saying that that aspect of Gnosticism does not describe the process anymore.
It's not relevant for his particular metaphor.
Okay.
Although it is an issue, generally speaking. And the other thing is the Job experience, where the self turns negative and tries to kill you. So in the first one, the alchemy, you've got the conflict and you try to synthesize it. In the second one, you actually create the conflict by withdrawing the projection within yourself. In the third one, the self is no longer an ally, but it's an adversary.
What's an example of that,
Gary? Job. Abuse. People who have been attacked. McGuire's book, Seven Deadly Sins, she calls it a study of the psychosomatic reactions to evil. When you have been attacked by evil. Child abuse, rape, attempted murder. I mean, I've had to deal with all of those things down the line, one time or another. And what those people dream of is that the person who's trying to kill them is God.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you can work with it, that negative God transforms, and it. So you have to realize that this too is a transformational experience. But it's tough. If you've been the victim of evil, your life's never the same. How did we get off on it? It was a point I was trying to make.
It was your wonderful question. I'm glad
you asked. It was a question from last week's lecture.
What was the question?
You had talked about the...
Oh, the other models.
The other models.
Yeah.
Besides the Sophia.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. And there's something, because Sandy asked me, does it have to be through the mess? And I said no, and the reason behind that is I think there are different models for the coming to consciousness of the self. Now this is something I have to think about, but I believe, however, more and more the experience which leads to genuine selfhood is more and more like the Sophia experience. Don't ask me why, but that the beginning of spiritual development seems to be more and more complications on the earth. And the end point of spiritual development is, like we've been talking about, to be lived on the earth. And that the nature of spiritual experience is changing. Now, why do some people get it one way and some people another? I don't know. I have a thought, and this is purely speculation, but, well, are you with this, or? Okay. Here's my thought why, but you asked for it. I have to back up. It has to do with Toynbee. Arnold Toynbee, the British historian. And his idea is that, and I will come back to where I started thinking, but I have to take a detour. A society moves forward by confronting an objective external danger. When that danger is successfully met, the successful solution to an external danger becomes an internal problem of an analogous sort. I'll give you an example. One he gives, he's written, you know, 15 books on this, and I have not read them, although I intend to. So I'm just giving the top. Greece faced the danger of the Persians. They banded together in the Delian League, and they defeated the Persians. The success of that battle was in their learning to cooperate as a union together, as a league. But the quarreling that that league produced internal to the society led to the Peloponnesian Wars, which destroyed the society. I think in our age you can say that the objective challenge we've successfully met is through technology eradicating basically, at least potentially, disease and starvation, and establishing infrastructure. If you've ever lived in the third world, it's so easy to take for granted what we have accomplished. When you watch dead babies floating down the river, you realize we have accomplished something. And you see the twisted faces from polio, and eyes and organs and noses and mouths all distorted from lack of nutrition during pregnancy. So that's an enormous accomplishment. But the very success has led to the possibility of armed destruction and nuclear weapons. Social tensions arising from the difference in levels of wealth due to capitalism. So our very success has led to the danger that we're going to be destroyed. He says that the artist then is the person who takes that new challenge to this internal society within themselves and in their work solves it, expresses it, and in a healthy society that solution catches on and it redirects the society. So he puts the artist as the key for the growth of a society. So see, that's a completely external analysis of what happens inside a creative person. But it's a nice link to us because he sees the relationship between political events, internal social structures, and what goes on inside itself, inside the interior person. Now, my thought is, see, this, so that's like coming top down, and the Sophia experience is bottom up. And when you wrestle with this complicated situation, you come up with a piece of your personality.
So are you contrasting it with Toynbee's experience?
Well, I think they meet in the middle. And that that new identity that you come up with out of the Sophia experience is the same identity that will solve the problem which has come down from the top. So that the physiology and the history meet in the self. And when it's your fate to be that person who articulates the problems of the time inwardly, when that is the self you are to become, then your experience is a Sophia experience. That's why I think maybe the difference between a Sophia experience and a non-Sophia experience. There's two different ways of saying the same thing. When you are to make a contribution to your society, and that contribution, in the extroverted sense, is your wrestling with the social problems of the society, that wrestling will come to you from the bottom when you are trapped in a Sophia experience and you begin to resolve it. What you resolve is not only your own personal problem, but it's the problem of the time. So it's when your personal struggle and the historical requirements of your society mix that you're more likely to get your challenge in life through the Sophia paradigm. You asked, so that's... And again, you see, this completely reframes the question of spirituality, because the spirituality then is what you are doing to solve your own problem as it hits you from your emotional messes. And that is, at the same time, you're being addressed by the social problem in your version of it. And as you work on it, you not only are solving your own problem, but you're solving the problem of your time. And that's the spiritual task of our time. It's right here on earth. It's nothing apart. So that, in a way, politics and physiology are the same. And since we are living in such a different time now, with the proximity of communication has brought, and the overwhelming power we have to destroy ourselves, maybe this is why the experience is shifting toward the Sophia paradigm. That's my thought. It fits in because, you see, it starts with the earth and it ends with the earth. I'm just trying to say that is the same time can be seen in a much wider social and historical perspective if you really know what's going on in the imagery of the time and the imagery of the Sophia experience. You'll see they converge. This is why I'm so excited about this Pali material. You can see that in him. He was wrestling with his own love problems. He was working on the imagery that they produced, and that imagery is at the same time the solution to the problem of the nuclear age. They aren't two different things. And I think if you find people who go deeply and are initiated into individuation through the crucifixion of the body, by crucifixion of the body, I mean desirousness, hatred, I think, you know, take Marian, eating issues, wherever the body is the thing that is persecuting you one way or the other, it is actually an attempt of the psyche to initiate a spiritual development. But it's just because we're dealing with the Sophia era, that's the way the spirit addresses us now. And that's what it was trying to tell Thomas in the 14th century, but he had no way of grasping it, but we are now able to grasp it. I gave a talk at this Kanuga conference a couple of years ago, and they were all, oh, psychology is nice, but you got to be active in politics. And see, they have absolutely no understanding that that inner journey is not separate from the themes of the time. If you go deep enough, and so people are saying, they are just telling me, they haven't done their work. Because if you do your work, as you will see if you want to stick this out with Pali, it is the exact same thing. The inner work and the outer work are the same. And you see they're different when you're too self-centered to really face yourself. When you get over your self-centeredness and you really face yourself, then you see the unity. So by working on yourself, you're working on your time.
That's my thought. But maybe it's useful as well to give you an idea why I think this stuff's so important. For people who are going to make a difference, this seems to be what they get hit by. There are other means, other ways to it, but the politically and socially relevant journeys seem to start this way. And again, right, it's right here in our text. Start with the earth, you end with the earth. That, to me, is what this chapter means. It is not complete until its earthly counterpart is fulfilled. Okay, questions?
I know we need to get back to the text, but I'd love to continue this conversation maybe after this. After we do this text, maybe we can spend more time talking about...
Well, if you want to do the Pali stuff, this is what we'll be talking about.
It was just...
How a unified human being is somebody who is both on an inner journey and an outer journey. And I think Jung would be the first to say, you know, what I did was the inner, because I only had one lifetime. But that is only half the story. The outer world is as symbolic as the inner world. And that you're getting hints of that in this text. We have not been able to see it because we've been so moralistically judgmental about the nature of our inner process. Like that woman. See, she would have never gotten to the deeper meaning of her life had she morally judged her adultery. As you have to be able to suspend a certain type of moral judgment to get to the inner process. But that inner process then leads you back to its own very much deeper committed moral contribution to life. Okay.
Just one quick thing.
Yeah.
I just have to say this. You know, remember the Buddha when they send the three temptations, and the last temptation they send the maidens, and then they send a war, and he separates himself from all. But the last thing they said is, "You can't sit out here because your duty is to be that being the king."
Mm-hmm.
And he reaches over and he touches the earth, and he says, "I have done my duty."
Mm-hmm.
Now that just puts it in such a whole different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was to do.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever your duty is, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he had to do. So that figure of him where he's touching the earth has just a really powerful meaning.
I think the difference between East and West is then that unconscious will lead you back to your work in the community.
In fact, you know, the whole dialogue between the East and West now, between Buddhists and Christians, is the Buddhists are teaching people how to transcend, and the Christians are teaching them how to do social activism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the marriage of the two.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's what women in particular that I'm studying, that's what the Buddhist and Christian women are doing.
Yeah.
And supporting each other that way. So it beautifully fits what you're saying.
Very important. I just think this is the task of the time. Yes, indeed. Okay, 352. Some of this stuff is going to be important. Some of it's just repeat. The beasts of the wood go about, for thou hast set them a bound which they shall not pass until the whitening, but in their order go on even until the reddening. And it starts off with that reference to night, and it is night, for in it shall all the beasts of the wood. What she basically says there is that there's a likelihood of one more outburst of instinct. And remember, you could say this whole Sophia experience was the animals breaking loose. Does it make sense if I put it that way? That the physiological, emotional mess that starts the process is when the animals break loose. When desirousness gets the upper hand. Either desire for or desire against.
The other thing, and that's not so important, but the other thing which is interesting just from the point of view of alchemical symbolism is the colors, black, white, red. And they are the classical alchemical symbols, colors, classical alchemical colors. The black is the depressive aspect. The white would be the unio mentalis, and the red would be the unio corporalis.
Synchronicity thing. I was just reading a book about the fates, talking about the colors being black, white, and red.
Generally, the black means you start out depressed. You get clarity. That's the white. And then you have to reactivate your emotional participation in the situation, and that's the red.
So what was the albedo, the unio mentalis?
The white would be the clarity, or the unio mentalis, the clear consciousness, the ego separated out. And then the red is the unio corporalis, where you take your feelings and you reinvest life with them. That would be like the blood on the rock. And believe it or not, this shows up in dreams. Like, I'm going down a road and there's a black sign, there's a white sign, there's a red sign. It's funny. And you can say, well, folks, here's what's ahead. It really does show up. And then it often, before it turns to the red, will often be the peacock's tail.
Which is?
Called a pogonus. The peacock's tail, the colors.
Oh, okay.
I just heard a dirty joke. Do you want to hear a dirty joke about the peacock? I shouldn't do this, but it's been a long day. The peacock's tail is what triggered it. This guy, young punk, was sitting at a food court, and he had, you know, yellow hair, pink hair, red hair, blue hair, orange hair, green hair. And there is this old guy just standing there, sitting there looking at him. He tried to ignore the guy, he turned back, and the guy would be looking at him. Tried to ignore him, turned back, the guy would be looking at him. He says to the mister, to the guy, "Mister, haven't you ever done anything crazy in your life?" The guy said, "Yeah, got drunk once. Had sex with a peacock. Just trying to figure out if you're my son."
I heard the same one with a parrot and the
So whenever you see peacock colors in dreams, you can think of my joy. So over to 353. For all things serve the earth. Again, that's what I was trying to talk about. How within this text you see that how the end point is not a description of spiritual separation, but of this worldly resolution. For all things serve the earth, and the days of its years are 70, passing over it because it upholdeth all things by the word of its Godhead. The author's idea is that before the final glorification of the substances as described in the seventh parable, there'll be one last outbreak. That's what we talked about. And that this has something to do with the human body. Then you skip down a little bit. For all things serve the earth. The words "all things serve the earth" are particularly significant because the author here puts the earth in the place of God. Psalm 118:91 says, "For all things serve thee." This earth itself is the risen Christ and the divine mystery. Indeed, it is God himself. That, to me, the Sophia experience, you see, has a different beginning, and it has a different understanding of the end, which is the earth is the
sacred.
I came across two two quotes which I thought illustrate this point from different sources, just to hear that we're not totally alone here. And I think it helps illustrate, again, not only that you visualize the new beginning of the religious experience, but that you can visualize the new end of the religious experience. And this is from Van Gogh. That's what I was, actually what I was looking for our Saturday class, and I came across it. He writes, "I want to paint men and women with a touch of the eternal, whose symbol was once the halo, which we try to convey by the very radiance and vibrancy of our coloring." See, the holy becomes the emotional intensity of the earth. That was, what, 1880. And another one of my heroes, Teilhard de Chardin, you know, he was a French priest, and he served as a medic in World War I, even though he could have enlisted as an officer. He enlisted as infantry, just so he would experience the fate of his fellow human beings. And this is from his biography of him called Spirit of the Fire, page 60. The biographer writes, of a vision he had at the Battle of Verdun. He was in the trenches. "Amid all the fray and danger of war, Teilhard sees and is lifted up by the face and figure of Christ, whose lines are melting away into the universe towards infinity. The entire world is vibrant with movement, with life emanating from Christ's heart, the dazzling center of matter. Here he first describes the radiant power, majesty, and beauty of Christ, to which he returned in later years again and again." See, at the Battle of Verdun, he saw that the living earth was Christ, nothing separate from it. So same idea, where the nature of what religious experience is described here. Jung certainly talks about it, but if you read with open eyes and ears, you hear it coming to you in other places. There is definitely a shift in religious consciousness. Okay. Three 54. Oh, and the other thing, that was just a way of saying that the earth equals God. And the ordinary human being, because it's the ordinary human life that is referred to. They were just some of the characteristics I tried to summarize. She says the earth equals. Again, a new understanding of the end of the experience. 354. As in the Turbit Philosophorum, that's the an alchemical text. The earth, since it is heavy, beareth all things, for it is the foundation of the whole heaven, because it appeared dry at the separation of the elements. And one more. Therefore, in the Red Sea, there was a way without hindrance, since this great and wide sea smote the rock, and the metallic waters flowed forth. Well, her basic point is there just that a new world is being created. But a couple of other things. Are you familiar with the Red Sea story? Everybody knows that probably. And you're familiar with Moses and the rock. What you see here is how the unconscious confabulates different images and coalesces them into one concept to express a particular point.
One of the things we can get out of this is just the image of the rod, which Moses struck the rock with, would be representative of the spirit in the unconscious, the guiding capacity of the unconscious, is being what creates flow. The other thing is just that this is an image of how the process is prepared to guide you through the complications to the end point. Like the Hebrews could make it across, but the Egyptians couldn't. Like Moses created water out of the rock, the capacity for resolution is built into the experience. And that's because the Sophia experience is meant to be an entry into the spirit, just in a way that we're not familiar with. Okay, 355. Then the rivers disappeared in dry land, which make the city of God joyful. When this, that's the most important thing, but I'll read it on. I'll read on. When this mortal shall put on immortality, and the corruption of the living shall put on incorruption, then indeed shall the word come to pass, which is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy victory? And we'll do that in connection with the next passage on 356. Where thy sin abounded, there now grace doth more abound. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ all shall be made alive. For by a man indeed came death, and by him himself the resurrection of the dead. Okay, let's look at those two passages. I'm just going to read you what she says after the passage on 355. I'm going to go slowly. Because it's one of these, it's, you know, again, it's one of these passages that, which are filled with paradoxes. And if you know the background, then you slowly get a sense that it's describing a coherent theme, but in paradoxical and confusing words. The rivers which make the city of God joyful disappear. That's the apparent rub. In dry land. Two biblical quotes. These two biblical quotations seem to contradict one another. But, yeah. Come in.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Is there a minister available at this time? I'm so sorry to interrupt.
I think the church offices are across the way.
Across the street?
Yeah, I think the second floor.
Upstairs here?
Yeah. No, across.
Across the street. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much.
These two biblical quotations seem to contradict one another, but they are probably meant as follows. The corrupting humidity, the divine water in its chaotic corrosive aspect disappears, and from it the secret earth grows up as dry land in the fixatio or coagulatio. Now, do you want to try to put that in your own words? What is the corrupting humidity?
negative things from the unconscious.
Right, that beginning state where you are, you feel like you're being ruined by the experience. The divine water in its chaotic, corrosive aspect. Now, what's so important about putting it that way? The divine water in its corrosive aspect, chaotic, corrosive aspect.
If it's corrosive, it can dissolve. It can.
Why does she say the divine water in its corrosive aspect? Again, it's the symbolic mind speaking.
It's in process.
I think you've got it. Can you spin it out a little further? The for the alchemist, see, we think, we have a difficult emotional experience, and we get to make it something of value, which is sacred. Their way of putting it is that beginning is one form of the sacred, and the end point is another form of the sacred. The corrosive aspect is the beginning form of the sacred. The redeemed aspect is the end point of the sacred. But they're both the sacred. It's just the sacred in its different aspect.
Yeah, you were trying to make some kind of distinction between the way they thought about it and the way we think about it.
Well, not you, because you probably think that way. not if you've been digging around in the unconscious, you don't see this as strange. But the rational mind says, we have a difficult experience and we redeem it into its higher form. But the alchemical mind says the lower form is just another form of that same thing that we're meeting in the higher form later down the road. Does that make sense? Yeah. Both are sacred. One is the sacredness in its corrosive aspect. The other is its sacredness in its redeemed aspect. Now, if you've been digging around the unconscious, this is not news. That's why I said that. But for the linear mind, it's like, I have a sinful experience and I redeem it, where they're saying, no, that first experience is simply the corrosive aspect of God. It's just as much God as the end point. It's just a different phase. That's what she wants to get out of it.
They would call it the devil.
Right.
They split it off.
Right. Right. Right.
Satan.
Right. I just think that that's a helpful phrase to remember. The corrosive aspect of the divine.
It gives a whole different way of looking at driving a car that's rusting. To a major suburbia area. You know? I mean, really.
You may be closer to God than you know. Yeah, that is true. If you look at our idea of beautiful, it is always new and shiny. And I guess that's what I loved about Europe. Their idea of what's beautiful is what's old. But it really affects our consciousness. I had to go up to, is it the clay terrace. And at first I thought, oh, how lovely. And I thought, my God, everything is shiny and new. And everything is a franchise. There's not one individual piece of initiative in any of those stores that I know of.
It's not. It doesn't feel like much of the spirit is dwelling in the earth with those buildings.
Yeah.
Like, but you feel in Europe like the earth has just emanated.
But at first glance, it looks pretty because it's this lovely little space carved out of freeways. But if you look at it, it's new, shiny, and that is how we think we should be.
It looks pretty, but it doesn't feel pretty.
It doesn't feel pretty, no, it doesn't.
They cut down an awful lot of trees.
Mm-hmm. To do that.
That was all.
That was all.
Yeah. But then we throw things away. I mean, the other side of that, if it's got to be new and shiny, what do we do with the old plastic cup?
Yeah, you throw it away.
Then, you know, we're throwing up and burying ourselves in landfills.
And you throw away the old rusty part of yourself, too. That's well, let's have a stretch. We've gone on.